This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The surface of Mars is a dangerous place for life. Without a thick atmosphere swaddling the planet, like the nice one we've got here on Earth, there's not much protection against all the harmful radiation zapping it from space. So, some scientists have hypothesized that life on Mars might seek shelter underground. For hints on what that underground habitat might look like, scientists have turned to Antarctica. And here to fill us in on the details, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Ariel Duham Ross. She's a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Welcome back.
Hi.
Ariel, tell us about what's going on there in Antarctica.
Right. So researchers discovered that there is actually a lot of salty water deep, 1,000 miles below the surface of Antarctica. And what's especially interesting is that likely there might be microorganisms in that water as well.
You
we
mean
don't
thousand
know yet.
Feet. Thousand feet.
1,000 miles.
1,000 miles.
1,000 feet. It might be. Yes, 1,000 feet. Definitely 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
So they found that there's water there, and that it probably has the environment that's able to support life.
Huh.
And that's especially interesting because that part of Antarctica, the McMurdo Dry Valleys, are very dry, they're very cold, and they resemble Mars.
I've been there.
Yeah, you have?
Yeah.
Oh.
Way before you were born.
So the idea is this essentially gives scientists hope that there may be life deep below
it's
Mars.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
yeah,
in the surface.
Yeah, so because, it's not hospitable. You mm-hmm. have that radiation coming in. Why, we go underground.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the dry valleys have no ice or snow on it.
So. No, they have no ice, no snow. The way that they did this study is that they used a helicopter with an antenna that was hanging from it that created an electromagnetic field. And they were able to sense the different kinds of materials that mm-hmm. were deep below ground. And some of it was water. There's a part of those valleys that's called the Blood Falls,
mm-hmm.
and they've been able to sample the water that comes out of it. It's very red water because of iron oxide, and there are microorganisms there.
Hmm.
So the idea is that there probably is life 300 meters below ground, and that probably means that there could be life on Mars as well. It's a proxy. It's a lot of assumptions,
yeah.
but it's
yeah.
it's still very exciting.
It is exciting to think about. Okay, second little short subject you've got for us.
Researchers announced that they were able to essentially cure 3 babies who suffer from tracheal bronchomalacia. That's a condition where the airways, they suffer from excessive airway collapse. Their tracheas mm-hmm. Can't stay open. And the way they did it is with a 3D printed implant that was tailored specifically to keep their tracheas open. Now, this condition is interesting because when kids live past the age of 3, they usually grow out of it. Their tracheas become strong enough. So what they did is that they created an implant that is sutured to the outside of the trachea and keeps it open. It's a semicircle, and it keeps it open. But what's especially interesting about this 3D printing implants have been used in medicine before, is that this implant, the way that it was designed, it was able to grow with the children. So as their tracheas grew, the fact that it was a semicircle means that it was able to expand, and it's also a material that becomes more flexible over time and degrades. And as it degrades, it becomes more flexible and it's able to open up, which means that these kids, these 3 babies, they were between the ages of 3 months old and 16 months. They're now alive. Their tracheas are open.
Wow.
And they would have died otherwise. The researchers, they had the most serious version of this condition. And the implants are now degrading. They're going to excrete them out of their bodies over time. And essentially, they're cured from this condition that would have killed them.
Another victory for 3D printing.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. You know, I guess they can try this on other kids now.
Well, exactly. They plan on doing it on kids who have a less serious version of this. I mean, it might be used for any number of conditions, really. What's interesting is that it's very futuristic. They scan these children,
right.
CT scan them to find out what shape their tracheas were, and then they... You know, using software, they designed this 3D implant and then they printed it out. And these implants only cost $10 to print. The material itself,
yeah.
the equipment is very expensive. but printing it was not very hard. So that's a huge advancement.
Let's talk about a story in the news this week about pap smears and how often women should new advice.
Yeah. So the American College of Physicians came out with a new guidelines this week where they say that women under the age of 21 should not get screened for cervical cancer. Women over the age of 21 should only get screened once every 3 years, and they should only receive a pap smear. And women above the age of 30 should get it. They can get it about once every 5 years with a pap smear and a combination of an HPV test. This isn't particularly new because in 2012, the American Cancer Society, the U.S. Preventative Task Force also came out with similar guidelines. What's interesting about them coming out now with this is that apparently since 2012, not much has changed. So 60% of women have reported getting cervical cancer screening tests before the age of 21, which is not part of the guidelines. Apparently, doctors have not been very good at reducing the number of tests. This is actually really important because if you over-test women, there's more chances that they will be required to do lots of follow-ups, which carry some negative health effects. Some, if you biopsy them, some women, when they become pregnant, are more at risk of having a preterm birth. There's also the idea that a lot of women in their 20s are actually have HPV. And if you test them very often, you're probably going to end up following up. And not all forms of HPV lead to cervical cancer or put you at risk for cervical cancer. And women in their 20s also often end up having abnormal pap smears, which also leads to more testing. And those abnormal, those lesions, those cervical lesions, don't necessarily lead to cancer. So if you test them more, you put women more at risk, and you don't necessarily give them better care.
Mm-hmm. One last thing, let's talk about penguin poop. Some new research on penguin poop. This just in.
So this is observational. Researchers at the University of Oxford have been filming penguins, a specific species of penguins called gentoos. And they noticed that the gentoos appear to use their feces to melt snow. Now, this is probably not conscious. This is just something that happens. It would appear that they live on an area where they essentially defecate exactly where they live. And this probably leads to the snow absorbing, the feces absorbing more heat, and then the snow melts.
Right.
It's actually quite impressive when you see it. There's a GIF on the internet that you can find that has the snow melting very, very rapidly. This probably serves a purpose. This particular species needs to breed on rock and not on snow. So this actually probably helps them survive.
Well, thank you. They're actually doing an old Benjamin Franklin experiment with dark. He discovered that dark stuff melts snow. He put it all out in the snow in different colors. Thank you, Ariel.
Thank you so much.
Ariel Duham-Ross, she's a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Next up, time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Our topic today is Flash. You know, Flash is that plug-in that people love to hate. You know, it's there in your web browser. It's losing ground on the internet, but a few brave souls are fighting for its preservation, at least in the annals of internet history. Jason Kebler wrote an article about this battle over Flash for the online magazine Motherboard, where he's a staff writer. Welcome to Science Friday, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Give us the good thing about Flash.
The good thing about Flash is it changed how we interact with the web. It used to be very text-based, very slow to load, and then Flash took us to this world of interactive videos, graphics, and music. I think everyone remembers like Homestar Runner. You get to watch all these cool videos, get to play games on Newgrounds, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And the bad thing?
The bad thing is it's insecure. It crashes your computer all the time. I think anyone who's like loaded too many tabs on Chrome knows that it can take it down. It's bad on mobile. Steve Jobs like infamously put a nail in the coffin of Flash when he decided the iPhone would never have it. And for that reason, it's losing its ground on the internet right now.
But so the problem is if we do away with it, we're going to lose all the archival stuff that needs it to run?
Yeah, that's part of it. So the Internet Archive's web crawler crawls all these web pages and saves them, but it doesn't save Flash files. So, for instance, all those restaurant websites that were like had music and were very annoying to use in the early 2000s are kind of lost to history if someone doesn't save them. And most people would say good riddance to that, but that was a really important time in the internet. And just like, you know, people want to play old DOS games or old arcade games, people are going to want to play old Flash games, or people are going to want to know how we experienced the web in the early 2000s. So there's this group of people who are basically downloading the SWF files and just saving them, like, en masse. And hopefully, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, you'll be able to load up a Newgrounds game and play it. Or you'll be able to look up, you know, the menu of a restaurant in New York, and you can see how annoying it was for all of us.
Yeah, I know. So what has taken Flash's place?
Well, HTML5 is basically replaced a lot of it, and it's still too early to say that Flash is dead, because a lot of websites still use it. They use it a little bit less intrusively than it was, you know, 10 years ago. But it is still used, and there's been so many, like, Flash is dead articles, but it's still kind of hanging on.
Does it always have to be refreshed or upgraded, or is it done? Is it not getting upgraded anymore?
I believe it's still getting updated, but not as often as it was, and they're few and far between, and there's still a lot of problems with it. I think people hate it because it does crash our computers, and because... you know, there have been in the past security flaws with it.
Yeah, not a great fan of Flash myself. So it won't be sorry.
Not anymore, but you know, you used to play maybe a game. You know, and
I remember.
Might want to fire it up sometime.
Yeah. All right. Well, somebody's saving it. That's good to hear. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Jason Kebler, staff writer for the online magazine Motherboard. We have to take a break. When we come back, the shady early days of psychiatry, and a few crazy treatments that won the Nobel Prize. You'll hear what I have to say, what we have to say about it after the break, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The history of medicine is full of strange and desperate cures. Consider the terrible night George Washington died. There was bloodletting, then a tincture of molasses, butter, and vinegar, which nearly choked him. Then more bloodletting and a mixture of vinegar and sage tea for gargling. They irritated his throat to produce blisters on purpose. Then an enema. And finally, more bloodletting. Our founding father lost more than 80 ounces of blood that night. The early cures for mental illness, on the other hand, are no less gruesome, like ice pick lobotomies. That's one of the topics of my next guest's new book, Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman. Lieberman is chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons here in New York. And we have an excerpt of the book up at our website, sciencefriday.com/shrinks. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here with you, Ira.
Thank you. Nice to have you. You write in the book, quote, "The profession for which I have dedicated my life remains the most distrusted, feared, and denigrated of all medical specialties."
Well, to put it in a little more cavalier way, I think of psychiatry as the Rodney Dangerfield of medical specialties. We don't get the respect we deserve. You were talking about the description of George Washington's treatment, which is probably as much responsible for his death as the illness for which he was being treated. And we've long forgotten and forgiven the past mistakes of internal medicine, surgery, and so forth, but we haven't in terms of the treatment of mental illness, and that was a big motivation to write the book.
So why haven't we gotten? We've forgive the old doctors. Why can't we forgive the psychiatrists, mental illness?
I think because it took psychiatrists and medical science longer to really come to terms with what the cause of mental illness was, how to define it, and to develop effective treatments. So it really was the late bloomer of medical specialties, and it only recently was able to make a credible case to regain the trust of the public. It really began after World War II in the 1950s. So when you think about it, it's only been in the last half century that psychiatry has had a scientific foundation and could offer anything that was remotely capable of producing therapeutic effects.
But before then, we used to hear, what happened to Freud? I mean, you mentioned in your book about how Freud has, you quote Edward Shorter, who says, "Freud's ideas, which dominated the history of psychiatry for much of the past century, are now vanishing like the last snows of winter.
Right. Well,
people used to quote him all the time.
And still do.
Woody Allen movies is full of it, you know?
And still do. I mean, yeah. We have Freudian slips. We have defense mechanisms. We have all kinds of references in our vernacular. Freud was brilliant and is the most famous and important psychiatrist in history, but he's also, it's as I put it, most calamitous rogue in the book. And the reason is because Freud came on the scene. He was actually a neurologist, not a psychiatrist, but the brain doctors had overlapping areas of interest in the 19th century. And he came on the scene when there was an intellectual vacuum. There was no understanding, scientifically speaking, whatsoever, what caused mental illness. We had some idea of heart disease. We had some idea of cancer. We had some idea of infectious disease with Pasteur. We had no idea with mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. Freud invented this brilliant theory which filled the vacuum. The problem was that it was a theory that pertained to how the human mind developed and functioned in normal instances, or for what I call the worried well. It had little to no relevance to what we know as mental illness, but it was extended to all manner of mental illness by Freud's proteges, his successors, the neo-Freudians, and that begat explanations for schizophrenia by what was called the schizophrenogenic mother, the mother who was contradictory and gave double messages. It produced the cause of autism being the refrigerator mother, the cold, remote, uncaring mother who didn't bond with her infant. And the worst sin of all was it allowed psychiatry to be utilized by society as an instrument of its moral prejudices, and it determined homosexuality as a mental disorder. Mm-hmm. Ostensibly caused, according to psychoanalytic theory via the neo-Freudians, as a result of a castrating, domineering mother and a weak, effete father. So Freud was really a brilliant person who made a breakthrough, but it was extended way beyond its relevance, and psychiatry had nothing to counter it until really the scientific revolution in the 1950s.
And you mentioned that along came Eric Kandel. Well, and helped put, you know, who really liked Freud, right? And then had to change his whole view, actually helped take down Freud.
Well, you know, in the history of psychiatry, just like in all fields, there's heroes and villains. Mm-hmm. Freud was a hero, really, but he suffered an unkind fate because of, in the same way some people might say Christ suffered an unkind fate in the way that Christianity has produced sort of warring factions. But Kandel was really a maverick who was a visionary. He was, like Freud, born in Vienna. He and his family had to flee Europe because of the Nazis, because he was Jewish. He landed in New York, went to college at Harvard, intending to understand what could cause his countrymen, who had been his friends, to turn on him. And he met someone there who said, well, if you understand human nature, you have to become a psychiatrist. So he decided to go to medical school. But while he was becoming an analyst, which was really the path towards psychiatric success in academic medicine, he thought, if I'm going to study the mind and mental illness, I think I should need to know something about the brain. So he decided in the summers to spend time in the laboratory of a brain scientist, and that led him really off into the scientific wilderness, because neuroscience had not yet been defined, and he basically forged the path to which psychiatry is now hewing, yeah. Which is a path of understanding how the brain underpins behavior and mental illness.
Discovered the methods of memory storage.
Exactly. He won the Nobel Prize in 2000 for discovering the molecular and cellular basis of memory.
And he's an old friend of this program, so we've had him on many times. He's talked about it. Let's talk about some of these cures. You write about that electroconvulsive therapy, which started out in those early days and got sort of a bad name in the popular imagination in films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and things like that. It's still used today.
Very much so.
With much evidence to support it.
I have patients in the hospital this very day who receive treatment, and it's for them life-saving. You know, it's ironic, Ira. There's been three Nobel Prizes in history for psychiatry. Mm-hmm. Kandel received the third. The first, though, was given for something called malaria therapy, where they infected insane patients with the blood of victims of malaria.
And it worked?
It only worked for people who didn't have schizophrenia but who had tertiary syphilis. But at the time, there was nothing else for anybody. The second was for the Portuguese neurologist Moniz, who developed the prefrontal lobotomy technique that was infamously adapted by Walter Freeman with ice picks. In between then, two Italians developed electroconvulsive therapy, and that didn't get the Nobel Prize, but it was the one treatment that really worked and is still used today. And despite its notorious reputation, it's totally undeserved, and for people who medications are ineffective for or are so dire, you know, so severely ill that they are either actively suicidal or not eating and drinking and close to having severe medical complications, ECT is a lifesaver. And there's people who you know who are public figures, anonymous, of course, in terms of their psychiatric histories, who are functioning. And if it weren't for their ability to continue to get ECT, wouldn't be in the positions they're in.
People in politics today.
Politics, people in entertainment, people in the news industry. It's not the Thomas Eagleton situation
right.
anymore.
Right.
But at the same time, these people aren't coming out publicly and talking about it.
So tell us about the ice pick. I mean, that just sounds wow.
Well, you know, it's easy to think that the people that did this were venal, barbaric, cruel. But we have to resist the temptation to view it through presenteeism, looking at the past through the future's lens or the present's lens. At the time, the only hope that medicine could offer people who had severe forms of mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, psychotic depression, autism, was institutionalization. There was no treatments to alleviate their symptoms unless they spontaneously remitted. And so psychiatrists were desperate. And Moniz, who was actually not a psychiatrist, a neurologist, developed this technique because the idea of understanding the brain, neural circuits, the brain underlying the mind mediating behavior was gaining resonance. And so he determined, because people who were insane seemed to be so frenetic and so overactivated, that perhaps if we excise some of the circuits in the brain, this would calm them down. And that was the basis of it. But when Walter Freeman, who was an American neurologist, said, look, the way Moniz developed it, it could only be performed in the operating room. You needed to have a neurosurgeon to drill burr holes in the skull and then introduce the scalpel to sever certain circuits in the frontal lobe. I want to make it practical so that a doctor could do it in his office. And he adapted the method to go through the eye socket with an ice pick. And tragically, by the time he was finished, about 3,000 people in the United States had had prefrontal lobotomies, including President John F. Kennedy's sister, Rosemary.
Yeah, I remember that story. Talking with Jeffrey Lieberman, author of Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. Let's go to the phones to Jason in Yorktown, Virginia. Hi, Jason.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, Ira and Dr. Friedman. Thank you for letting me talk on the show. I've been a long-time listener, but it's my first time calling in.
Long-time, first time. Yes, go ahead.
So I just had a question about the scope of the DSM. It's very broad, and we all understand that there can be a stigma associated with a mental health diagnosis, also understanding that some are, you know, more serious than others. But I was just curious if the doctor could maybe give his opinion on whether a majority of Americans would probably fit into one of the many diagnoses in the DSM, or whether if you were to assess everybody in the country, you know, you probably would have about the same numbers that we have now.
All right, thanks for that question.
Well, the answer is no, everybody would not fit into a diagnosis. There's 265 diagnostic categories. If you do the math with the epidemiology, it turns out that it may be one in four individuals within their lifetime will experience one of these conditions. And they happen at different ages of life. So some might encounter them as children or adolescents, others as adults, others in middle age, and others in senescence. But it's about 1 in 4. It's still quite a large number. But I think what you're getting at is there a tendency for psychiatry to kind of proliferate these diagnoses, try and pathologize normal behavior, and drum up business for themselves and the pharmaceutical companies? That's the rap that the anti-psychiatry critics level at us. And the answer to that is flatly no. Mm-hmm. There's no, all of the diagnoses have a credible scientific basis for them. Many of them seem to be unusual. They seem to be, in some cases, even frivolous. But they are vetted, they are studied before they can ever get formal designation as an illness. And there have been some very controversial ones. For example, one of the new conditions that was added to the DSM-5, the most recent revision, is called hoarding disorder. It's about people who can't throw things away, they keep them. Now, you say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, my husband, my wife, my sister, right. My brother, they're pack rats. They don't throw things. People with hoarding disorder, it's so extreme that their apartments, their houses are filled ceiling to floor, wall to wall. They don't throw anything away. There are health hazards with vermin. They haven't been out of the house because they're tending this for months and years, and they have to be rested by their family members or the police.
They even have reality shows on TV now about it. Let me just remind everybody, in case you joined us, talking with Jeffrey Lieberman, author of Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We've got a couple of minutes before the break. Let's talk about a couple of other things. When did talk therapy make a comeback, or did we lose it?
Oh, we've never lost it.
I mean, was that beginning with Freud and then kept going?
Yeah, Freud developed this theory, which was the first real theory of, you know, the mind and by extension mental illness. And after his theory, he needed to find a way to make it therapeutically useful. So he developed what was called the talking cure, and the talking cure later became defined as psychoanalytic therapy. Lying on the couch, free associating, telling your dreams, and so forth. That was a very innovative thing at the time. It's a very, in some instances, effective approach, if for nothing else, in giving a person insight into their own personality and how they behave. The problem was is that Freud was a control freak and wouldn't allow it to be subject to scientific verification, so it was never verified. But the renaissance of talk therapy came really in the 1960s and 70s when psychiatry required scientific verification of every treatment, whether it was ECT, psychotropic drugs, or talk therapy. And people like Aaron Beck developed what was called cognitive behavioral therapy. Right. Myrna Weissman developed interpersonal therapy. Dialectical behavioral therapy. So there has been a renaissance in developing these evidence-based therapies.
But we hear so much that psychiatry has now just become, give it a drug, give you a drug, we'll give you more drugs until we find the right drug that works for you, whether it's for ADD or for bipolar or something like that. And talk therapy is sort of adjunct to the drug side.
Well, it depends on the illness and what the necessary treatments are. So I think there's a couple of things which pertain to that. First, you know, to the comment that we over-medicate our society and we're giving people a pill instead of trying to find out the real problem. The reality is there is some degree of probably excessive or inappropriate prescribing, particularly in the area of stimulants for ADHD, antidepressants, anxiolytic. But you want to know something, Ira? We prescribe painkillers too much. We prescribe antibiotics too much. We use orthopedic arthroscopic surgery for degenerative arthritis when it's ineffective too much. And the fundamental reality is, even though this is no way an excuse for promiscuous prescribing, there are vastly more people who have severe mental illnesses who don't get treatment with medication than there are people who have illnesses or have symptoms which don't warrant treatment.
All right, we'll get back, talk lots more about this. Talking with Jeffrey Lieberman, author of Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. Quite an interesting book. If you'd like to talk about psychiatry, our number 844-724-8255, or just tweet us at SciFry. We'll get your message either way. We'll be back after the break. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Stay with us. In case you just joined us, you're listening to Science Friday from PRI. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Jeffrey Lieberman, author of Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. And when I rudely interrupted him to go to the break, we were talking about whether there's overprescribing of drugs in psychiatry. And you were making a valid point that there's overprescribing of drugs in all fields of medicine.
That's right. Because psychiatry is really the scapegoat in so many ways in medicine. Psychotropic drug overprescription gets criticized, but it does exist to some. But the bigger problem, as I mentioned, Ira, is the fact that so many people who do definitively need and could benefit don't get it because of stigma and lack of access. But there's another factor that really plays into this, and that's in the modern age, we have this time pressure. Healthcare costs are burgeoning. The government is trying to ratchet them down with cost containment and healthcare reform strategies. Doctors are pressed for time, so it's harder to talk to the patient to try and really go into what's happening in their life to find out how this may be contributing to their psychiatric or emotional difficulties, and it's easier to sort of more expedient to write a prescription. The other thing is that many people don't get to a psychiatrist. It's their primary care doctor who they're seeing, and the primary care, in fact, the majority of prescriptions that are written for antidepressants, anxiolytics, hypnotics, sleep medications, are written by non-psychiatric physicians. And although they're trying to solve the problem, they often don't use the right medication or the right dose, and this contributes to what is perceived as medicating problems ineffectively.
As more states adopt the legalization of marijuana, are we going to see a change? You're shaking your head. You're shaking his head like crazy. I didn't have to finish the question. What's the answer?
You know, I mean, we're running a great social experiment here that nobody knows the outcome of. It's interesting. On Wednesday, Nora Volkow, the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse,
we
was
know her
up,
very
up
well.
Here,
yeah,
and for a meeting. And Nora had called me several years ago when this expansion of medical marijuana was being used, let alone legalizing it such as Colorado has done. And the thing is that you can understand the justification from the sense that, well, tobacco, alcohol, recreational intoxicants that are legal that we use are harmful in some ways, but we don't outlaw them. Marijuana is no more harmful than these. Why shouldn't we? The problem is we don't know what the consequences are to the full extent. And what we have an idea about is that although they may be readily usable and reasonably safe for adults, in kids, it's not the case. We already know that the use of marijuana increases the frequency of certain mental disorders, particularly psychoses. And we're now learning that the use of marijuana, particularly heavy use with potent forms, affects adolescent brain development. Now, you can say, well, the age to buy it is 21. They're not going to get it, but we know it doesn't work with alcohol. It doesn't work with cigarettes. They're going to get it.
Yeah.
So I think we're all holding our breath.
So you're saying we're just doing a giant experiment.
Exactly. This is a huge social experiment, and I'm sure that there will be an impact on the frequency of specific mental disorders, particularly in youth, as a result of it.
We have about a minute left. Can you summarize for us where you see psychiatry going, headed? What's the trend at all? Is there a trend in the future?
There absolutely. I mean, psychiatry was the runt of the litter, the late bloomer, but it is now entering what I really believe is a golden age. And that's because previously the brain was so complicated, and the areas of the brain that mediated behavior, mental function, and mental illness were the most evolved and sophisticated forms of the brain. We couldn't get any understanding on them, but because of the scientific revolution, genetics, imaging, pharmacology, molecular biology, now the President's Human Brain Initiative to develop neurotechnology, psychiatry is going to be catapulted forward. And there will be a renaissance in how it's diagnosed and how it's treated. The big problem and the major motivation for my book was that the old attitudes and stigma still prevail. And as you know, psychiatry has the dubious distinction of being the only medical specialty with an anti-movement.
And that's a good place to end. It's a wonderful book, Dr. Lieberman. It's terrific. Jeffrey A. Lieberman, author of Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. You would think that it'd be hard to read. This is a really easy read and very informative. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. The death toll from the earthquake in Nepal could go as high as 10,000. Scientists had predicted that the area was at risk, but there still isn't a way to predict when or where an earthquake will strike. Why is Nepal sitting on such shaky ground, and how can cities increase their earthquake resilience? Let me introduce my next guest. Brian Tucker is a seismologist and founder and president of Geohazards International, based out of Menlo Park, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good morning, Ira. Great to be here.
Thank you. Is there something unique to Nepal that makes it more susceptible to earthquake?
Well, Nepal is as susceptible as its neighbors in northern India, Bhutan, Sikkim, northern Pakistan. What makes Kathmandu unique is that it is located in an old, dried-up lake bed, similar, by the way, to Mexico City or Caracas, so that any earthquake motion that comes in below it gets amplified. Depending upon the frequency, it can be as much as 10 times. So that makes it particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Kathmandu suffered quite a bit of damage. You've been there. What did it look like before the earthquake?
Well, it was, as a seismologist and as with some of my best friends being structural engineers, I was really attuned not only to the bad soil conditions, but to the terrible buildings around me. And I just remember walking down narrow alleys and streets, just shuddering, because it felt like you could almost touch with your hands both sides of the alleyway. And rising above you, five or six stories high, would be unreinforced brick buildings. So
you thought it was an accident waiting to happen.
Oh, gosh, yeah. You just, it's like having some superpowers that you can see, you feel like you can see into the future. You know what's going to happen here. With the combination of magnitude 8s roaming around the neighborhood, the terrible soil conditions, the terrible building conditions, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling knowing this and trying to motivate some change and improvement.
Is there resistance to building, and especially now with rebuilding, and to a certain way to do it correctly?
I wouldn't say there was resistance. I mean, first of all, I was there. We started there in the mid-90s. And at that time, I remember talking to a minister in the government and saying why I was here, and I wanted to help, and I was working with other people in the city, and he said that there's nothing to worry about, because Nepal had already had its earthquake in 1934. And I tried to explain to him, pointing to the Himalayas outside his window, that those indicate that more earthquakes are here to come. So it wasn't, I would say, a resistance, but it's a lack of motivation, lack of enthusiasm to do it, because they were facing so many other social problems. And after the king died and was assassinated in 2001, there was increased political unrest in the outside of Kathmandu. So they had a lot on their hands.
And so what do you think the future for them is in terms of rebuilding? They'll need massive aid, obviously, in doing some work. But what's the best way to build in that area?
Well, you know, our organization and my experience is in trying to go to places before the disaster hits and trying to make changes. And we don't specialize in response and recovery and all of that. But having seen the effects of poor construction, I I have some opinions. Obviously, the donors who are going to be helping in the reconstruction should insist on modern building codes being used and, you know, actually used. There has to be some cost allocated to enforcing, inspecting that the buildings are actually being built according to modern code, not just that the modern code is around, but actually inspecting the construction. I wish that they would use material and design that can be replicated so that the reconstruction process is in a way a training process so that construction after this boom would also be earthquake resistant.
Many of the temples in Kathmandu were destroyed. Are these older buildings the most vulnerable in an earthquake?
I wouldn't say so. For me, the buildings that, and I repeat, I'm not a structural engineer, but for me, I would walk around with lots of structural engineers, and my understanding is that the most vulnerable were these rather modern buildings that were 5-6 story high, unreinforced masonry, not particularly good concrete, no rebar in sight, and the first story was opened to allow commerce, to have shops and big windows for shoppers to see what was on display. And this lack of shear walls in the first floor made it what was called a soft first story, which if you can picture a house of cards, the first story is extremely wobbly even by itself. But then when you pile on it 5 or 6 stories of brick, it's just absolutely feeble and ready to come down.
Talking with Brian Tucker, seismologist and founder and president of Geohazards International, based in Menlo Park, California, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. What work will you be doing with Geohazards International in Nepal in the future?
Well, that's funny you should ask. People have asked me that before, and they kind of expect for us to wade in and help. Of course, if there's something that our expertise and our contacts and our resources could really help, of course we would do that. But right now, I see the world's engineers and search and rescue people and all flooding in there. And we are a small organization that is specialized in trying to find where the next disaster is going to be and trying to figure out tricks to motivate them. And so for me, now that the earthquake has sadly occurred, my glance is going to the east and to the west. We have an office in Bhutan, and they've been very cooperative and have worked well with us as we've tried to strengthen their schools and hospitals. Mm-hmm. But boy, they are even more motivated now, and we would love to have key risk managers from Bhutan and Sikkim, let's say, come with us and see what happened in Nepal, and then come back to Bhutan and look into the future and try to make a difference there.
Do you think that they're going to have another earthquake? I mean,
oh my gosh, that's as sure as anything you can count on.
Any time scale when that might be? Or it's just, you know, no one can really predict dates yet in earthquake prediction.
No, not at all. Not at all. But if you see a map of the South Asia and where India plowed into Asia and China, what is now China, it looks like a string of pearls going from the west in along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border up to the north, and then snaking across the northern India along the base of China, Nepal.
So that's
Bhutan.
Where all these earthquakes could happen, where the
absolutely.
That's why the Himalayas are pushed up from all these earthquakes over the years.
Absolutely.
And right inch by inch it goes up.
Inch by inch. Yeah. That should be a good song. but there was a big earthquake near Nepal in 1833 and 1950 and 1934. So
it's going to happen.
Absolutely.
All right. Brian Tucker, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Brian Tucker, founder and president of Geohazards International, based out of Menlo Park, California. One last thing. One of the perks of this job is being able to hobnob with the heavy hitters. But three Nobel Prize winners in 1 week, it's enough to make even this grizzled reporter's head spin. This week I got to chat with Eric Kandel, Adam Riess, Roald Hoffman, not to mention such science luminaries as Oliver Sacks, Sarah Siga, Freeman Dyson, Priya Natarajan, and Kent Sembeck. Whew! For me, someone who barely squeaked through chemistry class, I often feel like the dumbest person in the room, which I often am. But I am happy to be, as long as these folks are happy to have me hanging around. Can't hang around anymore this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Alex Lim is our associate producer. SciArts producer, Andy Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And what's got science? Prizes, beer, and me. It's our first ever Science Friday trivia contest. Yeah, come to Brooklyn. Brooklyn, May 13th. That's a Wednesday. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia before they run out. That's our first Science Friday trivia night in Brooklyn, Wednesday, May 13th. Tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. I'm Ira Flato in New York.